Hello, everyone. Good to be here. Sorry we couldn't see everybody because COVID thing. Everyone's afraid, I guess. Like Mark said, some of these big churches just totally shut down and they're not here at all. So anyway, like Christ said, be not fearful, little flock, for it's a Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. So that's what we have. When I think about Armando and Jennifer and then, boy, everything they went through, you know, those are real spiritual. They go through a lot of tribulation. And it really makes them grow. So they've been through a lot. And I miss all of them. And I miss Eva and Jason and their family and all them. They were a lot of fun. And, well, we're going to have fun anyway. And we're going to be praying for them and hope that everything turns out for the best of them. Now, did you know that the words you use can cause you brain damage? Did everybody know that? It's true. This is a book called Words Can Change Your Brain. Right here. This one I'm going to go over. Words Can Change Your Brain. And what I went over this book and I started going through it in the first 30 pages. I go, wow, this thing is packed with a lot of wisdom. You know? But it's interesting to see the secular world finally catch up with the biblical world, because much of the principles they put out here through much study and research we've had for thousands of years. So I'm going to connect the two, and we're going to see the importance of our words. So anyway, I'm going to go over some of the introduction of the book. You know, some of the stuff on the dust cover. Sometimes it feels like the more we talk, the less we are heard. But in a groundbreaking research, Andrew Neumberg, MD, and Robert Waldman have discovered a powerful strategy called compassionate communication that allows two brains to work together as one. Now, that is pretty interesting, because if you see in the scriptures... Oh, I forgot my mouse. Let me get my mouse here. Remember when Christ said this in John 17:11? And now I am no more in the world, but these are in the world, and I have come to thee, Holy Father. Keep to thy own name those whom thou hast given me, that they may be one as we are one. So many try to use this to say that justify the Trinity, but they're talking about the mind being a mind meld that takes place. And that's what we're going to go over here, is this mind meld. And as he says, compassionate communication allows two brains to work together as one. And 12 clear steps, that's what we're going to be going over. There's 12 steps we're going to be going over. Compassionate communication actually changes our brain structure, as well as the brain of the person you're talking to, in a way that helps establish a bond between people. In this unique state, free from conflict and distrust, we communicate more effectively, listen more deeply, collaborate without effort, and succeed more quickly at our task. Using data collected from MBA students, couples in therapy, caregivers, and brain scans, Neumberg and Waldman have seen again and again that compassionate communication can transform a difficult conversation into a deeply satisfying one, literally in a matter of a few minutes. Well, you can't get anything quicker than that. We can see the results in just a few minutes. Now, here's what some of the people said about the book. This is Daniel Amen, MD, author of Your Brain to Change Your Age. It says, a rare book. To teach the reader in a matter of minutes how to speak well and listen well. The authors show why everyday communication doesn't work and how to change the unconscious inner dialogues that stop us from honestly interacting with others. Best of all, it is supported by the most recent advances of brain and communication research. John Assar, the author of The Answer, says, one of the best personal development books of the decade. Michael Beckman, from the author of Life Visioning, combines years of neuroscientific research on the power of our spoken word, facial expressions, and body language with the 12 real-world practices, equally applicable in the boardroom, in the bedroom, and in the most read for those who want to better understand and communicate who they are in all forms and aspects of relationships. Herbert Benson, M.D., Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard University. And their noteworthy new book, Nuremberg and Waldman, show you how to listen and speak more effectively in a fashion that will actually change your brain. As a result, you'll communicate and get along better with others. Thank you. And Pilley, M.D., he's a professor of psychiatry at Harvard University, bringing together insights from neuroscience, psychology, and spiritual development, Waldman and Nuremberg offers a profoundly simple and effective way to turn ordinary conversations into extraordinary events. Chris Manning, Ph.D. There's a couple of them talk about the business application of this. So I'm not going to go too much over that. But now here's the author's note. It says, the book represents a new model for how the brain creates unique language systems that are designed to convey conflict information to others. And that's what we're going to be going over. Isn't it? Makes you chomping at the bit to hear this, isn't it? The ways we choose out our words can improve the neural functioning of the brain. In fact, a single word has the power to influence the expression of genes that regulate physical and emotional stress. And there's a verse I want to go over that speaks about this. 2 Timothy 1:7, for God hath not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. If our mind is to be sound, then we have to communicate, not just effectively, but properly. And that's what we're going to be going over here. If we do not continually exercise our brain's language centers, we cripple our neurological ability to deal with the problems we encounter with each other. Language shapes our behavior, and each word we use is imbued with multiples of personal meaning. So, this is extremely important. Although we are born with the gift of language, research shows that we are surprisingly unskilled when it comes to communicating with others. The emotional effects that can have on others, we talk more than we need to. We listen poorly without realizing it. The conversational shortcomings are not caused by poor education. Rather, they are largely related to the underdeveloped brain for the areas that govern the social awareness, empathy, and related language skills that are not fully operational until you're about 30 years old. Research shows that anyone, young or old, can exercise a language and social awareness centers of the brain in ways that will enhance their capacity to communicate more effectively with others. To date, we have identified and documented 12 strategies. Now, here's the 12 strategies we're going to be going over that will enhance the dynamics of the conversation, even with strangers. They can stimulate deep empathy and trust in a listener's brain, and they can be used to interpret negative thought patterns that, if left unchecked, can actually damage your brain's emotional regulatory circuits. Now, here's the 12 strategies of compassionate communication. Number one is relax. No, you need to relax. Stay present. Number two is staying present. I had a book that was given to me by my sister-in-law, and it was on meditation. And there was a chapter in the book called Monkey Mind. And I guess all people who practice meditation are familiar with this term. And they use the analogy of a monkey going through the jungle, going from branch to branch. And they have, they said that's what happens with monkey minds. We jump from one thought to another. And they had an exercise in the book, and they had you focus on a singular thing, and it was a pencil. And it was just a silly amount of time. I think it was 14 seconds. All you had to do is focus on that pencil for 14 seconds. And I'm telling you, you have so many thoughts coming into your mind, you wouldn't believe it. How hard it is to take time and just focus on that pencil for 14 seconds. And that's what we end up getting. In fact, our culture encourages this monkey mind, multitasking, constantly thinking about what we have to do next. You know, when Paul said, redeem the time, some of us think we're supposed to hit the ground running and run in all directions at the same time. And that's, we're far more productive if we concentrate on single aspects of his teachings. Okay? Now the next one is cultivate inner silence. Number four, increase positivity to keep things positive. Oh, okay, you're writing that down? Okay, cultivate inner silence. Number four, increase positivity. Number five, reflect on your deepest values. A lot of people can't communicate their deepest values. You know, if you ask them, they're hemming and hawing. They really don't know what their deepest... So you need to concentrate on what your deepest values are and anchor them in your mind. Number six, access a pleasant memory. When talking with someone, access a pleasant memory that you had. It comes across. You know, they pick it up. They sense it. They sense the pleasantry you're thinking of. Number seven, observe nonverbal cues. Now, I notice that the people who are grown up in broken families, they're real good at this because, you know, if their parents are fighting, if they're alcoholics or whatever, they pick up on these nonverbal cues and they're real smart about it. Because they're constantly watching their parents and wondering which direction they're going. Are they going to be happy today? And they just... That's one superpower that comes out of those who have to experience that. You know, a broken home, I guess you could say. Number eight, express appreciation. That's very important. But I teach all my grandkids, no matter what I give them, I want them to say thank you. Because just that appreciation just makes your life so much better. It really does. Speak warmly. Number nine is speak warmly. Number ten, speak slowly. It's funny to me because when I was in boot camp, I can remember this guy from Tennessee, and he spoke real slow. And I said, well, how come you guys from down south speak so slow? And he goes, you Yankees sound like a bunch of queers to us. I didn't want to say nothing to him. This guy was really good at shooting, you know. But it's funny because I guess up north we don't speak slowly. If you go down south, they're real slow and they're measured. And we're all over the place. Speak briefly. Speak briefly, number 11. And number 12, listen deeply. I remember meeting a guy in the club. He was in a tennis club. And I like people. I talk to people. They all think I'm a salesman or something. I'm trying to sell them something. But this guy, when I started talking to him, his face just was right into mine, and he's paying attention to me. I mean, intently, you can sense it. I said, what do you do for a living? He said, I'm a life coach. That's why I can tell. Because he focused right in on you when he spoke. And it says, if we practice these 12 strategies, for just a few minutes each day, you'll think more clearly, you'll enhance your creativity, and you'll generate more authentic dialogues with others. You can even eliminate conflicts before they begin. So let's, who doesn't want to do that? We call this strategy compassionate communication, and when you use them in your conversation, something quite surprising occurs. Both of your brains begin to align themselves to each other. Make them one as we are one. You shall know them by their love one for another. And if you exercise these compassionate communication strategies, you're going to be exercising love for one another. This special bond is a phenomenon referred to as neural resonance, and in this enhanced state of mutual attunement, two people can accomplish remarkable things together. Why? Because it eliminates the natural defensiveness that normally exists. Okay, so compassionate communication was originally developed as a tool to help couples. As a recent brain scan research shows, the more deeply we listen, the more our brain will mirror the activity of the other person's brain. This is what allows us to truly understand another person and to be empathetic with their sorrows and their joys. In fact, every change we make in our lifestyle is perceived by the brain as a stressful event, which is why compassionate communication gives special attention to developing strategies that decrease stress. John Watkins does for software development. Okay, anyway, I'm not going to go through all this. But anyway, he does all these exercises that he has all his employees start out with every day. And it's based on compassionate communication. And boy, they have the highest people coming to work, no sicknesses, and they couldn't figure out what it was. And they start every day exercising with this compassionate communication. No criticism can come in. Everybody just starts the day communicating with each other, and they solve problems like nobody else. And it's a real interesting how it works. It says in less than 20 minutes, a team can identify the most essential goals for the day, and coming up with creative suggestions that can be rapidly evaluated, modified, and implemented. Okay. There are only three rules: relax, speak slowly, and take turns saying whatever comes to your mind without censorship. That's what they did in that exercise at work. Make sure that you respond to only what the person just said. That's kind of hard to do because, everybody has spoke to other people and you know they're thinking in their mind their next point. They're not really listening to what you're saying. They just want to bring up what they have to say, and they're not really listening. I think we're all kind of guilty of that once in a while. Okay. Most people say, "But I need time to explain." That may be true, but if we talk for several minutes, the other person's brain will only recall a fraction of what you said. And it might not be the part you wanted to convey. The solution, brevity, followed by intense listening to make sure that the other person has grasped the key points of what you said. If you have, great. You can say another sentence. So brevity is a key. Saying things, Shakespeare was known for that, you know. He would say things in pictures and a lot of times, and he was known for his economy of words, but saying a lot with less words. When we limit ourselves to speaking for only 30 seconds, the brain quickly adapts by filtering out our relevant information. There's another advantage of speaking briefly. It limits our ability to express negative emotions. Extreme brevity keeps the emotional centers of the brain from sabotaging a conversation. Anger rarely works. This discovery contradicts the popular belief that people need to express their feelings of frustration to effectively process anger. That's the traditional understanding of psychoanalysis now. Yet the moment a person expresses even the slightest degree of negativity, it increases negativity in both the speaker and the listener's brains. Instead of getting rid of anger, we increase it. And this can, over time, cause irreparable damage, not only to relationships, but to the brain as well. It can interfere with memory storage and cognitive currency, and it can disrupt your ability to properly evaluate and respond to a social situation. It interferes with making rational decisions. and you're more likely to feel prejudice towards others. What makes anger particularly dangerous is that it blinds you even to the fact that you're angry. Thus, it gives you a false sense of certainty, confidence, and optimism. So it'll blind you to your own anger. You can see, so I call them diseased minds, because usually those who practice this, they'll repeat contradictions they're not even aware of. You know, complete contradictions of what they're saying. Expressing anger is destructive. Unconscious anger and a constant flow of stress hormones and neurochemicals it relates to can literally eat you alive, damaging the emotional regulation centers of the brain. Research shows that the best way to deal with negativity is to observe it inwardly without reacting and without judgment. There's another way to prevent negativity from creeping up into the conversation. Express frequent comments of appreciation. There's always something sincerely you can appreciate about somebody. You don't even have to make it up. You can always find something you can compliment someone on. The more the better, but they need to be heartfelt and genuine. They just can't be something you just make up and, well, you know, like somebody trying to sell something, you know how they compliment you to death, and the Bible talks about stay away from somebody who compliments with the lips. And talk about all the positive events in your life and avoid complaining about the world. When it comes to positive and negative feelings, the brain responds like an on-off switch. It cannot focus on both at the same time. As we will explain in the next chapter, negativity is more powerful. That's why we have to maintain the highest positivity ratio we possibly can if we want our work relationships and lives to flourish. And always remember, as the Bible says, the just man falls seven times and rises again. So if you mess up, go back, do it again. Don't give up. Think before speaking. We found that speaking spontaneously without censorship could sometimes cause problems for the listeners. So we added another rule. Before you speak, ask yourself, can the other person hear what I'm about to say without becoming upset? If the answer is no, or even maybe, then put that thought aside and bring it up at a later time when the other person may be more receptive to it. In the meantime, you'll be able to think about alternative ways to getting your message across. That's another biblical verse. That, I'm on my computer. Oh, here it goes. Well, it talks about, it's in Proverbs, and it says, a word spoken in due season, how sweet it is. I can't find it on my... But this is what they're talking about here. Wait for the proper time to speak it if it's not the time to speak it right then and there. So a word spoken in due season, how sweet it is. Oh, here it is. Proverbs 15:23. A man who hath joy by the answer of his mouth, and a word spoken in due season, how good it is. Because some people will ask me to talk to someone, and I'll say, well, I'll wait for the opportunity to present itself. You'll know. But you got to do it in due season. You just can't go right out there and confront them right away. Sometimes things come up, and it makes it a lot... It's easier to swallow for the other person. So, that's another biblical principle that was brought by her. And we learned that the basics in grammar school and high school, but if you want to excel in communication, you have to unlearn many bad habits and replace them with advanced skills like empathetic listening, being able to put yourself in the other person's shoes, do unto others as you'd want done unto you. You have to study the mechanics of the verbal inflection, and you have to learn how to read facial expressions that most people tend to ignore. You have to immerse yourself fully in the experience of speaking and listening, and you have to practice. It's something we have to continue. If we want to master it, we got to practice it. And you'll see it. You'll sense it. When you start using, I've been using something like this for years. It hasn't been defined like this. But you'll sense it in the other person. You do become one mind. You got the mind meld going on. Now, to improve conversational skills, we need to do four things. Number one, recognize the limits of your personal communication styles. Number two, interrupt old habituated patterns of conversing. Number three, experiment with new communication strategies long enough to build new neural circuits of behavior. It reroutes the neural circuitry in your brain. This is how important it is to have this compassionate communication. Consciously apply these strategies when you talk to others. We suggest that you spend 5 to 10 minutes each day practicing the different components of compassionate communication. After a few weeks of practice, you should notice a significant difference in how you relate to others. Words can heal or hurt. Take 3 deep breaths and yawn a few times. This is the most effective way to reduce physical, emotional, and neurological stress. You know, the first step is to relax, you know, and this helps you to relax when you take a couple deep breaths. Now stretch out your arms before your head, drop them to your side, and shake out your hands. Gently roll your head around to loosen the muscles in the neck and the shoulders. And take 3 more deep breaths. This is a relaxation exercise. Make yourself comfortable around the other person. You know, some people are afraid to go up and talk to other people because they're afraid they might not be receptive. We shouldn't be afraid of that. And you might encounter people like that, but the majority that I've ever dealt with, it's not like that. People feel complimented that you want to talk to them. They really do. That seems to be the normal. Okay, it says the same holds true for children. The more negative thoughts you have, the more likely they are to experience emotional turmoil. But if you teach them to think positively, you can turn their lives around. Negative thinking is always self-perpetuating. The more you are exposed to it, the more your own or other people, the more your brain would generate additional negative feelings. It feeds on itself in thoughts. In fact, the human brain seems to have a capacity to spend more time worrying more than any other creature on the planet. And if you bring that negativity into your speech, you will pull everyone around you into a downward spiral and may eventually lead to violence. I knew a guy that he was raised on negativity, and no matter what I told him, he'd always think of something that's going to go wrong. You know, he always, and I told him that, I said, you know, you're just totally self-destructive here. Every time, you know, you think of something, you always think of what can go wrong. And that's the way he was trained growing up. You know, you always think of everything that can go wrong. Fearful words. Angry words send alarm messages through the brain, and they partially shut down the logic and reasoning centers located in the frontal lobes. So anger can bypass a lot of important tools we have with our brain. Words shape the reality we perceive. This is a real interesting study. Mark, I know you and Mary are familiar with this Japanese doctor, Emoto, who did the scientific study with the water. And they would use words and water and glasses of water, and they would measure it under a micron electron microscope, and they would see the structure of the water would be beautiful, geometric. It would be like a snowflake. And when you use negative words, it's all discombobulated, and we're mostly made up of water. And they're totally discombobulated, and they did the same thing with music. Which was interesting is they taped on pieces of paper words on these glasses, and they had the same effect, and it made no difference what language it was. Japanese, German, it made no difference. And it would have the same effect on that water, how it was just beautiful, structured, and if you, and they did it with music. They used they use that acid rock music, and I mean that the molecules were all over the place, you know. And then they used like Mozart or something, and everything was lined up and, like I said, geometrical. It's like snowflakes. They look like snowflakes. Human brains like to ruminate on negative fantasies, and they also add in another way. They respond to positive and negative fantasies as if they were real. Now, we have that in, Paul tells us that, Philippians 4:8. He says, finally, our brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think on such things. So he told us how to think. We're not to fantasize about negative things. I like to fantasize about the kingdom a lot of times. What is it going to be like? You know, and I play a lot of that. You know, it's not so biblical, but I know that Paul said, you know, eye has not seen or ear has not heard what Yah has prepared for those who love Him. So I like to fantasize with those type of thoughts. To make matters worse, the more emotional we get, the more real the imaginary thought becomes. But imagination is a two-way street. If you are intensely focused on a word like peace or love, two of the words that they used in that Dr. Emoto's experiment, your emotional centers of the brain calm down. The outside world hasn't changed at all, but you will still find more safe and secure. This is the neurological power of positive thinking. Now, certain positive words like peace and love may actually have the power to alter the expression of genes throughout the brain and the body, turning them on and off in ways that lowers the amount of physical and emotional stress we normally experience throughout the day. But these types of words cannot be grasped by a child's immature brain. So Paul, again, talks about that in 2 Timothy. I want to go over that. He says this, for God has given us the spirit, not the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. These are the type of exercises that create the sound mind, where we become one mind as we speak with others. We become one like the Father and the Son is one. Second Timothy 1:7. Yeah, you guys speak right out if I'm going too fast. I know I got a family and that isn't afraid to do that. Me and Leo think the same way. Here's an interesting thing they brought up. What do words taste like? What do words taste like? And that too is another biblical verse. In Job 34:3, it says this, for the ear trieth words as the mouth tasteth meat. The ear trieth words as the mouth tasteth meat. Now, here's what it says here. What do words taste like? Words, you may be surprised to hear, have different flavors. And speech can trigger sensations in your mouth and gut. High tones tend to taste sweet or sour. And low tones taste salty. As one Oxford scientist put it, bitter flavors taste like a trombone. Studies like this show that communication is a multisensory process, and if we speak too fast without awareness of our physical and emotional state, we may overlook cues that provide important information for solving problems and working with others. Now, some people are just going to be crabby, but you know my philosophy, everybody is entitled to a bad day, you know? Just kind of let them move on. Oh, this is an interesting thing I found in here. Thinking in pictures. Thinking in pictures. Because if you'll notice, the Bible uses a lot of metaphors. Because you'll find out, like from this thing here, the language of the brain is pictures. It's not words. That's why you see in the Bible, Revelation 13, I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns were 10 crowns. They're putting pictures in your mind. It's interesting because I went to go study metaphors. And you know what I came up with that really surprised me? Hypnosis. Hypnosis uses a lot of metaphors because the language of the brain is pictures. And Christ spoke in metaphors, which gives us pictures. Okay, here's what it says. Thinking in pictures. Before we learn to think in words, we instinctively think in pictures. As our brain continues to develop, we gain the ability to think in increasingly abstract ways. The following illustration shows how we mature from the language of pictures to the language of words. Now here, they show different pictures of a sailboat. They show a photograph, and then they show somebody drew a picture, then a symbol, and then somebody writes out sailboat. There are four different aspects of how the brain deals with that. In general, pictorial language is processed in the rear regions of the brain, while abstract concept engage in language regions in a frontal lobe. To communicate effectively and have meaningful dialogue with others, we need to use a combination of words, symbols, and images. So to master metaphors would be a good thing if you're going to be a communicator. To master metaphors, because they deal with, or similes, because they deal with pictures. Consciousness demands that we stay in the present moment and not be distracted by the inner commotion of the brain and the outer commotion of the world. Now, like I said, we're trained from the television to every media source for our brain to be going in every which direction, which they call multitasking, as I said. But our whole culture has our brain doing just the opposite of what we should be doing. Calm down, relax, and focus on one thing like that pencil for 14 seconds. Try that sometime and see if you don't notice it. Brevity reduces conflict. Brevity reduces conflict. Sometimes even 30 seconds is too long, especially in situations where emotions run high. Even limiting the dialogue to 30 seconds sometimes do not help. So we change the rule. Everyone, including the attorney in the role play, oh, he's talking about a situation where it was a divorce proceedings, and they couldn't agree on nothing. So he was using this compassionate communication to break the logjam of their negotiations in this divorce proceedings where emotions are really high. So even limiting a dialogue of 30 seconds did not help, so we changed the rule. Everyone, including the attorney in the role, was limited to one sentence, lasting 10 seconds or less. Within 5 minutes, the attorney was able to move the stalemate to a point of a mutual agreement. By severely limiting communication, the ability to express anger was removed. That's the funny thing about anger. Not only does it give the person a false sense of self-righteousness, it neurologically generates more anger. It perpetuates itself. And then they talk about all the body language involved. I mean, when you're exercising compassionate communication, everything goes into line properly. Your body language, your face. So this is why it's real good to practice this. Now I'm going to go over a couple verses that kind of verify this. Verify what they came up with this compassionate communication. Philippians 2:2. Ye be like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord and of one mind. We're supposed to have one mind. And if we exercise this compassionate communication, we all become one mind if we're concerned about the other person. And sometimes, like, some people don't get it with the Bible. Sometimes they have to have, you know, some type of study before they really connect. And it's a legitimate stepping stone. Sometimes we have to use earthly things to understand spiritual things. As Christ told Nicodemus, who was a doctor of the law, very intelligent, rational, And he was trying to explain some things to him, and he couldn't understand it because he was speaking in metaphors. And Christ says, if I have told you earthly things and you believe it not, how shall you believe me if I tell you heavenly things? So you have to understand the earthly things also. For verily I say unto you, this is Christ speaking, for whosoever shall say, not think, but whosoever shall say unto this mountain, be thou removed, and be thou cast into the sea, and shall have no doubt in his heart, but shall believe those things which he saith shall come to pass. He shall have whatsoever he saith, if you believe it. Now, our words are extremely powerful. And I'm going to go over a couple of verses. And Proverbs 18:21 says this. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and they that love it shall eat the fruit thereof. I mean, what you say, you're planting a tree. Is it a tree of thorns and thistles? Because you're going to be eating it. Or is it a tree of luscious fruit? So you're going to eat the fruit of whatever you put out. So, some people need the physical to understand the spiritual, and it's a legitimate stepping stone. Paul says this, I therefore, a prisoner of the Lord, beseech you that you walk worthy of your vocation wherein you are called, with all lowliness and meekness and longsuffering, forbearing one another in love. This is how we're supposed to treat one another. And when we do this, it's a huge spiritual blessing. Not just to you, but to the congregation. We have spiritual knowledge that's revealed to us. And that knowledge is not revealed if we are not practicing this. Christ said to one of the churches in Revelation, if you do not repent, I'll remove your candlestick out of your way. Well, the candlestick gives us light. Candlestick is a revealed knowledge that Yahweh gives to us. We will not receive revealed knowledge. As he told Daniel, go your way, Daniel. It's not your way to know. It's not for you to know right now. You know, it's for the end times. We get chunks of revealed knowledge as we go along, and we will lose that if we do not practice this type of compassionate communication. Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem other better than themselves. How many of us can practice that? Do we esteem people here better than ourselves? I think I'm the greatest person in the whole world. But that's the way most of us think. Do we esteem others better than ourselves? If we do, we'll take an effort to practice this compassionate communication. Let everyone of us please his neighbor for his good to edification. I just love that word edification in the Bible. To edify, to edit. It means to build up, to lift up, not destroy. Are our words being used for edification? Are we helping the other person when we use these words? So edification is extremely important. Romans 14:19. Let us therefore follow after things which make for peace, and things wherewith one may edify another. So we need to edify. So he's not just telling us to do these things because he wants us to be a bunch of nice people. He's doing it for our own good. If you want that sound mind, practice these things. Philippians 4:8. Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Now, I'm going to leave off here with what Christ says in Matthew 12:36. But I say unto you that every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give account therefore in a day of judgment. Now, are our words edifying? Are they helping the other person? Are they lifting up? Because every idle, single idle word we say, we're going to be given account for in the day of judgment. So we need to keep that in mind as we go forward. And this would be truly a blessed feast if we practice these methods.